Mankind Under Wrath, the fifth talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 10, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're going to get into the text of the book of Romans. I'm going to skip the introduction and the greeting. We'll come back to that and sample that and examine some of the statements in there as we go along. But I want to jump right into the heart of the argument of the book of Romans. Basically, this first section, what I'm calling part three, if you have my translation, we're going to be in chapter 1, verse 18, if you're working from a normal Bible. We'll go from 1:18 to 2:2, but we'll take a couple of weeks to look at that section. So I want to just look at the first sentence, the first statement in the section, and the conclusion, and then basically talk about what the section as a whole is doing. What we're going to find is that Paul's point in this whole section is to simply assert universal human depravity. Now, as you know, occasions come along like Mother's Day, and I don't typically pause to go topically. We just deal with the text at hand. There is a connection, however. Every depraved human being was brought into the world by a mother. I'm going to read the whole section, and then we're going to focus on the beginning and the end of the section. The wrath of God is directed from heaven against all the disregard of God and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. Because what can be known about God is evident among them. God has made it evident to them. From the creation of the cosmos, his invisible attributes are understood by way of the things he created. His eternal power and deity is clearly seen, with the result that they are without a defense. Because while they knew God, they did not acknowledge his glory as God nor respond in gratitude. Rather, they became unintelligently futile in their reasonings, and their ignorant heart was darkened. Claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed beasts and of crawling reptiles. For this reason, God abandoned them to impurity and the desires of their hearts, with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves. These very people swapped the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who, it is certainly so, is eternally praiseworthy. On account of this, God gave them over to degrading passions. In fact, their women, on the one hand, swapped their natural desire for sexual intimacy for one that was against nature. Similarly, the men also, forsaking their natural desire for sexual intimacy with women, were consumed by their lust toward one another, males committing a shameful act with males, and were bringing upon themselves the penalty that was required of their error. Inasmuch as they did not judge God worthy to include in their understanding, God abandoned them to their defective mind so that they did those things that were not appropriate, having been filled with all unrighteousness, evil, self-exaltation, wrongdoing. God abandoned them to being full of envy, murder, contentiousness, deceit, malice. God abandoned them to being manipulative liars, slanderers, haters of God, insolent people with an exaggerated sense of their importance, people puffed up with self-delusion, pretenders, inventors of evil, those who are disobedient to parents, people who are ignorant, people who are utterly faithless and untrustworthy, people unaffected by normal human feeling and compassion, people who are implacable, people who utterly lack mercy. And while they understand the demands of God's justice, that people who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do they do these same things, but they also grant approval to those who practice such things. So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment, For insofar as you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation upon yourself. For the one who is passing judgment is practicing the very same things, and we know that the just sentence of God is rightly and truly upon those practicing such things. Okay, I want to begin by taking apart and looking at the pieces of 118, that's paragraph 8. We'll start there, and then we'll jump to paragraph 12 and look at the conclusion of this section. He begins by talking about the wrath of God being directed from heaven. The wrath of God is really a relatively simple concept. It's an obnoxious concept to a lot of people, but it's a very simple concept. God has an antipathy, a negative response to human evil. Our experience with wrath, of course, is almost always in the context of evil and wickedness. So it's very easy for us to have difficulty thinking of God being wrathful. If God is a good God, how can he be wrathful, is our response, because we don't know wrath in any other context other than wickedness and evil. But conceptually, there's no difficulty with understanding how a righteous and good God could have an antipathy toward wickedness and evil. And I think that's clearly what Paul has in mind here. It's his antipathy and hostility toward that which is wrong, that which is against everything good. God does not tolerate it. God does not like it. God does not accept it. He rejects it. He repudiates it. And wrath is the way the Bible describes that. A question about this passage is, what are we talking about here exactly? There's two senses in which you could talk about the wrath of God. There's the objective sense and the subjective sense. In the subjective sense, it would have to do with what's going on inside God's mind and heart and will, or inside his person, whatever God's person is like. You know, what is his feeling? What is his orientation? What is his inward experience toward evil? That would be wrath in the subjective sense. So if you hate someone, but you never act on it, you just seethe inside, you are hating them subjectively, but you are not hating them objectively. You're not doing anything concrete about it. Well, this could be talking about God's wrath in the objective sense, where just as if your hatred towards someone led you to punch them in the nose or slash their tires or, I'm not experienced at this, yeah. Or whatever, if your hatred were to lead you to act concretely, that would be your hatred toward them, the objective manifestation and expression of that hatred. Well, is that what we're talking about here? Is Paul talking about the wrath of God in the objective sense, that he has some effect in our lives and in the world that he's pointing to and saying that's the result, the effects of God being wrathful toward us? In this particular context, I think he means it in the subjective sense. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all disregard of God and unrighteousness of men. What he's describing is the inner orientation of God himself directed toward all of us for our rebellion, our disregard for truth, our tolerance for evil. God is angry with us, if you will. He hasn't particularly done anything about it yet. The day will come when the wrath of God is objectified, when the wrath of God will have an effect in our lives. But I think primarily what Paul has in mind is the day when that will be objectified at the final judgment. There the wrath of God will be poured out. We're not there yet, but if you turn to, this is 13:3 on my translation. It's probably about 2:4 or 5 in your Bibles. But in accord with your hardness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourselves in the day of wrath and of the realization of the righteous judgment of God. That's the day where the wrath of God will become objectified, the day of wrath and the realization of the righteous judgment of God. When God finally decides to act, he will come to condemn, he will come to punish, he will come to destroy all that is evil. So It could be that that's what he's talking about in 1:18, but I don't think so. I think what makes the most sense out of the argument is that what Paul is saying is, as we sit here this morning, the fact of the matter is we all sit under the impending doom of God's inner attitude toward us becoming concrete and objectified. And the day will come with that when that's going to happen. Well, we now live in the shadow of the doom of that destruction because God is wrathful toward us. I've translated it, the wrath of God is directed from heaven. Most of your translations probably have revealed. I didn't double check this, so I may be speaking beyond what I remember here, but I'm not sure revealed ever means revealed in the way that you and I typically use the word revealed. It's not that information has been disclosed to us. Some secrets have been disclosed to us about the wrath of God. Rather, what he's describing is God's orientation toward us is, and as I said, directed toward us. Or literally, I think the word means unveiled. So when was the wrath of God unveiled, really, in a way that we could know it? In the garden, I think. When God stuck those mean-looking cherubim between Adam and Eve and the tree of life and kicked them out of the garden and came into the garden asking to talk to them, and Adam and Eve were ashamed and hid. That was God's wrath became known to them and became understood to them because God's wrath became a reality that day. Before that, in their innocence, they did not have the wrath of God directed toward them. They were not subject to the wrath of God, but they became subject to the wrath of God that day. And all of mankind ever since then has lived under the shadow of that doom. God is angry at who we are. If you have any questions about that, I'll show you some other passages where I think that same verb is used in a way that doesn't really mean revealed. So I think it's best captured the way I've translated it here. The wrath of God is directed from heaven against all the disregard of God and unrighteousness of men. From heaven, nothing particularly mysterious about that. It could be from God in his transcendence, or it could be from God in his position as divine judge, in his abode as God and sovereign over the universe. They basically come to the same thing, so I don't really think it makes any difference. But the point is, in his role as sovereign God and therefore divine judge, what is his disposition toward us? His wrath is directed toward us. And why? What is it directed toward? All the disregard of God and the unrighteousness of men. Most English translations might have godlessness. They might have impiety. Impiety is probably actually more accurate. The problem with impiety is that it means diddly squat to us. I mean, we don't understand that term at all. So impiety is basically that position, that stance toward the divine beings that you don't take them seriously. I mean, in pagan culture, an impious person was someone who didn't take offerings to the god, didn't worship the gods, didn't serve the gods, didn't do anything to take their reality and their actuality seriously. Well, translate that over into the Judeo-Christian worldview. There is a God, a transcendent creator God, the author of all reality. And our perspective toward God, our view, our mindset toward God, makes all the difference in the world. The most prevalent mindset is this word, asabeas, impiety. We disregard God. And that disregard for God ranges from everything toward a sense of the irrelevance of God and no real particular interest and concern in God to out and out hostility to God and everywhere in between. But no matter where it falls on that spectrum, the thing that all has in common is we don't really take God as God seriously. And that's the source of the wrath of God. It's directed from heaven against all the disregard of God that exists among us as human beings, all the disregard of God and the unrighteousness of men. I think we're going to see here in the two paragraphs, we won't look at that this morning, we'll look at it next week, but in the intervening paragraphs, we'll see the connection that Paul thinks exists between a disregard of God on the one hand and unrighteousness on the other hand. That the one follows from the other. Why are we immoral? We are immoral because we are in rebellion against our Creator. We have an antipathy toward our Creator. We're hostile toward our Creator. And that hostility translates into all kinds of depravity and perversion. A disregard for truth, a disregard for goodness, a disregard for love, a disregard for everything that God stands for ultimately gets manifest because of our disregard for God. So they're connected in Paul's mind here, and you see it connected in the very thesis statement of this section. The wrath of God is directed from heaven against all of our disregard for God, our Creator, and the unrighteousness that follows from that in our lives. We'll talk more about this in the future, but it becomes very apparent in this part of Romans that the essence of sin is not our lack of morality. That's a symptom. That's a problem. But the essence of sin is our bad relationship with our Creator. Everything else that we consider sin flows from that. But at its essence, it's our hatred and hostility and antipathy toward God that is our problem. There are all kinds of people out there in the world who are wonderful creatures, who are wonderful human beings. They were made so by God. And in the wonder of their wonderful humanity, they can be incredibly loving and good and creative and imaginative and be a delight to know and a delight to love and a delight to interact with. As I'll go on to talk about this in a second, but that's not our problem. The problem is not that we're losers. The problem is not that we are that we're mass murderers. The problem is that we hate God. So no matter how wonderful as a creature we are, we're not really taking our Creator seriously, and that's the essence and the heart and core of what makes an evil person from Paul's perspective. We'll talk more about that later. Then he goes on to talk about it's directed from heaven against all the disregard of God and the unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. Now, there's two ways to take that clause, who suppress the truth in their righteousness. It could be a restrictive clause or it could be a non-restrictive clause. A restrictive clause would be, I have an example here, let me find it. Oops. I thought I did. Well, I'm sorry. See if I can remember it. Human beings who must breathe oxygen to live is a non-restrictive clause. We're not talking about two kinds of human beings who must breathe oxygen and human beings who don't have to breathe oxygen. Every human being has to breathe oxygen to live. And so the clause is simply describing something true about the noun. If I said human beings who must who must have a clean environment to live or something like that, now that's a restrictive clause. What I'm talking about is that class, that set of human beings who have to have a certain environment in order to be happy. There's another class of us slobs who can transcend our environment. But we're a different class of human being. So the question is here, which is he talking about? Is the wrath of God directed against men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness, a class of men? Some do, some don't. Or is he saying it's directed against men universally, across the board, human beings, every last one of them, because it can be said of every last human being that they suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. It's the latter, I think, and I think that will become apparent by the time we're done with the whole section. So his thesis statement then is that here we are, every human being of whom it could be said that we suppress the truth in our unrighteousness, the wrath of God is directed toward us from heaven, from his sovereign place. What's the truth that is being suppressed? What is he talking about? Well, that's what the intervening paragraphs are all about, paragraphs 9, 10, and 11. We'll look at that next week. But to make a long story short, basically the truth that we suppress is the truth about our Creator. We do not acknowledge him as God or respond with the appropriate kind of gratitude to God. If we really faced into the truth of who God is, we would serve him, worship him in gratitude. But we don't, we're not interested in that, and how is it that we avoid that conclusion? We simply ignore the truth about him. We suppress it, and we don't take it seriously. So that's what he's going to go on to talk about in the next three sections. Okay, and he says they suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. Well, I'll talk more about this in a second, but there's a connection between the moral condition of my inner being and what I will and will not believe. It may seem like what I believe or not is not really a moral issue and that it's really unrelated to the kind of person I am, but not so from Paul's perspective. From Paul's perspective, what you are willing to be open to believing is a very sensitive barometer of the state of your moral condition. That's why belief is such an important issue in the New Testament. Whether or not you believe the truth, whether you're going to be saved, hinges on whether you're going to believe the truth. Why? Because God is interested in people believing stuff? No, it's not belief, but it's what that belief represents. It represents the state and condition of one's inner being. And the sinner, the rebel against God, the unrighteous person who's fundamentally unrighteous, the one truth that they cannot abide and will not abide is that I'm a creature created by the Creator, and I owe my allegiance to him, and I owe him gratitude, and I owe him my service. That's the truth that we simply are hostile to when it comes naturally to us to become hostile to that. Okay, there's three important theological implications, I think, of this thesis statement here. One is that what we do not believe can in fact be an indication of a moral state. If we suppress the truth in unrighteousness, then our suppression of truth is a symptom and an indicator of unrighteousness that's at work within me. Second implication, a very important dimension of human evil is the orientation of the human being toward God, and indeed, I will argue that a disregard for God is the very essence of human evil. All other manifestations of human evil ultimately flow from our disregard for God. Okay? That's the thesis statement for this whole section. And that's what he simply wants to go on and elaborate on, develop, and underline, is we're all in big trouble because every last one of us is a creature who does not adequately have regard for our Creator, and as such, we are under the doom of God's wrath. And in the end, at the end of existence, that's going to translate into our condemnation, our punishment, our destruction. That's what he wants to affirm in this section. Now we go to skip over to chapter 2, verse 1 in your standard Bibles, or paragraph 12 in my translation. So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment. To stand without a defense, what he has in mind is he obviously has in mind a kind of courtroom metaphor here. We're before the judge, in this case the divine judge, but we have absolutely no basis for being able to convince the divine judge that I'm not worthy of condemnation. And what Paul is saying is, what are you going to say? What are you going to tell him to tell him that you're, to convince him that you're not worthy of condemnation, given the kind of person you are and the attitudes of your own heart? What are you going to be able to say? You have no basis for being able to convince him of anything other than the need for your condemnation. So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment. Now, what is he talking about? What he's talking about by passing judgment is that act whereby we look at other human beings in our lives and we see the way they behave. We see what makes them tick inside, and we look at that and we go, that's damnable. There's no excuse for any human being ever having that attitude, practicing those things, being the kind of person that they are being. There's no excuse for that. That's a damnable way to be. Sometimes we do that rather matter-of-factly and casually as we just observe other people, but all of us do it when we've become the victim of other people's evil. If someone has lied to us or cheated us or dealt with us unjustly in any way or have attacked us and harmed us in any way, we instinctively, automatically know that wasn't right. And it's not a matter of we instinctively know that I didn't like that. That's true, I didn't like it. But something else wells up. Not only did I not like it, it wasn't right that you did that to me. You have violated something bigger than me. You have violated objective reality itself. Human beings shouldn't be that kind of being that you have been in the way you treated me. That's the passing judgment that he's talking about. And we all, again, I'm going to argue that from his perspective, every human being does that without exception and should do that. Then there'd be something morally stunted about us if we were incapable of doing that. Of course we have to discern what is good and what is evil, determine what is acceptable way for a human being to be and what is an unacceptable way to be. But he goes on, for insofar as you condemn the other person, same word basically in Greek, for insofar as you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation upon yourself. For the one who is for the one who is passing judgment, you who are making that judgment about other human beings, is practicing the very same things. And we know that the just sentence of God is rightly and truly upon those who are practicing such things. What does he mean by everyone who passes judgment in that way that I just described does the same things? He doesn't mean that I do exactly the same things. When I point to the cruel murderer and say, that's wrong, that's damnable, Paul is not saying, well, you've murdered. You know, you've been a cruel murderer as well. When I condemn the rapist, it doesn't mean I'm a rapist. When I condemn the liar, it doesn't necessarily mean I'm a liar. I may not have done exactly the same things, but that's not his point. But by the same things, he means things of a comparably damnable and perverse nature. Not exactly the same deeds, but deeds with the same moral consequence, deeds of the same moral worth and value, if you will. And so he says, insofar as you condemn other people, thank you. Insofar as you look at other people and recognize how damnable their behavior is, you are demonstrating the fact that you're capable of making the discernment between good and evil, that you're capable of recognizing how grave an offense evil is. You've demonstrated that because you've recognized it in other people. They've done wrong, and it's wrong to do wrong. It's horrible to do wrong. You recognize that, and you recognize the consequence of that. You recognize that God would justly destroy you for being that kind of being. You recognize that that's true of all those other people out there. But he says, in so doing, you condemn yourself. Because if you'd apply that same judgment to your own life, you'd recognize that you do comparably damnable things yourself all the time. So there is no, you stand without an excuse. You won't be in a position to plead ignorance. Oh, I didn't know evil was bad. Oh, I didn't know that was evil. You know, God's response is going to be, well, you knew it was evil in them, and you knew it was damnable in them. So why can't you see that in yourself? Why can't you see that you are just as toxic, just as destructive, just as much a force of disruption and alienation and evil in the world as they have been? And you know it's damnable in them. So if it's damnable in them, it's damnable in you as well. Okay, something that's important to note here. Paul is here in this section, in 8, in 12, and in all the intervening paragraphs. Paul is not trying to prove that every human being does damnable things. He's not proving it. He's asserting it. In a similar vein, Paul is not proving that every human being has the knowledge that damnable things are, in fact, worthy of condemnation. He's simply asserting it. So it's not fair to criticize Paul for giving a weak argument for these claims when he never attempted to give any argument for these claims. That's not his purpose. His purpose is not to prove it. It's to simply lay it out there as the beginning point for a larger argument by asserting what he's assuming his readers will be able to recognize as true without a proof. He doesn't feel the need to prove it to his readers. He thinks that it will be quite evident, my own depravity, and the depravity of everybody, will be quite evident to anyone who's honest in his or her appraisal of himself. Particularly anyone who is honest about what he actually does and how he actually behaves should most certainly see the truth of Paul's assertions. So he doesn't feel any need to prove it. He just is reminding us of this thing that every day of our lives is giving evidence of. So notice then that the conclusion in 12 basically recapitulates the thesis statement that he makes in paragraph 8. So in 8 he says the wrath of God is directed from heaven against all of us. And then 12, what does he say? So you stand without excuse, every one of you, all of you, stand without excuse, because you demonstrate that you have the wherewithal to know how damnable we all are. And that same scrutiny would bring you to a recognition of your own damnability as well. Another thing to note that Paul is not saying you all stand condemned because you sit around judging other people. That's not what he's saying. Sometimes people read it that way. Paul assumes that we judge others, and his whole point assumes that we do so rightly and appropriately, that we're fully capable of judging other people in the right sort of way. What Paul explicitly says is that we're condemned for doing the same things that we judge in other people. The condemnation is not for judging evil evil. The condemnation is for doing the evil that we judge in others. That's the point of the condemnation. Right? So what is Paul's purpose here? I'm going to come back now to 9, 10, and 11 next week, but I want to look at the whole section here for a second. What is his purpose here in part 3, in the end of chapter 1 and into 2? He's laying out the fact of universal depravity as a backdrop for our understanding of the gospel. His point is not to assert how loathsome human beings are. That's not what he's saying. Rather, his point is to assert how guilty human beings are, and hence what a tragic end is in store for every human being. Those are not the same thing. And I know that in many of our minds, we mush them together and we combine them, and we think that anyone who would assert that you're guilty and unrighteous and damnable and a sinner is saying that you're loathsome and despicable and scum. That's not Paul's perspective, I would argue. That's not what he's saying. He's declaring the divine wrath, condemnation, the just sentence of God. He is never in, there's not a single whisper anywhere in this section about Paul talking about what losers we are, what failures we are, what loathsome garbage that we are. He's not saying that. He's saying we're guilty, not that we're nothing. Where he's saying that we are damnable, not that we're garbage. So his purpose, right up at the front of his argument, is to establish that no human being will receive eternal life because he is worthy of it. If a human being is granted life, it's as an act of divine mercy, as a grace, as a gift, not as a reward to some deserving person. So that's going to follow directly from what he's saying here, because what he's contending in part three is that every human being is morally depraved and hostile to God and therefore stands guilty before God. So how could we ever get eternal life by being deserving of it when we are inherently the kind of people who are not deserving of it? Okay, it's crucial that we hear the point that Paul wants to make here and not the point that we are accustomed to hearing. Some of us more than others, but probably every one of us to some degree or the other, have what you might call loser pronouncements that echo in our heads. What a loser. What a failure. What a worthless piece of excrement you are. And in one way or the other, that voice is in our heads, reminding us, seeking to remind us lovingly what a loser and failure and piece of excrement we are. When we're thoroughly accustomed to hearing those voices all the time, it's very easy to read a passage like this and think, yeah, there we go. Paul is just getting in line, getting in the queue. He's one more voice pronouncing us a loser, pronouncing us a failure, and telling us what jerks we are. But that's most definitely not Paul's point, is what I want to say. His point is not that we are garbage, that we're utterly disposable, irrelevant, unimportant creatures who have no intrinsic value whatsoever. How could Paul say that? Because Paul's perspective is that human beings are creatures created in the image of God. There is, as marvelous as God's creation is, God has done something in a human being that outstrips the glory of everything else that God created. We have been created in the image of God, every single one of us. I'm not really a fan of Bill Gothard, but there is one thing he said that I think is profoundly right. God don't make garbage. And I think that's really true, that there's every last one of us is created by God to reflect the incredible, magnificent glory of the person of God himself. We are the only part of God's creation that really has personhood imprinted on who we are, created into and embodied in who we are. And that's absolutely awesome. It is absolutely wondrous. And when you get to know people, I mean, society can come along and can make people so suppress the glory of who they are that they do become to look like losers to us. But it's because we're not seeing who they are. I think if we could know them, if we could get to know them, if they could reveal themselves to us, we'd see a marvelously gifted, talented, intelligent human being who is other than me, is different than me, and is glorious in a way that I could never hope to be glorious. That is Paul's perspective. That has to be Paul's perspective. He read Genesis 1. I mean, if anyone understands the implications of Genesis 1, it seems to me it would have to be Paul. So he can't be coming along here in part 3 of Romans saying, you know, the whole lot of us are just disposable garbage. There's just no worth in us whatsoever. We hear that because we've been telling us ourselves that over the course of a lifetime. And we just translate what Paul's saying into that. But I'm contending that Paul's making a very, very different claim than that. His point is that we are utterly evil and therefore deserving of condemnation by a morally good and just judge. But that's a different claim. The example I like to give is Sherlock Holmes. If any of you have read much Sherlock Holmes, he had a nemesis, Professor Moriarty. He had nothing but the utmost respect for Professor Moriarty. He thought that he was probably the greatest mind he had ever seen, yea, even maybe greater than his own, which was saying something. Sherlock Holmes thought Professor Moriarty was an evil man who deserved to die, and his whole life was devoted to finding him, catching him, and destroying him, because he deserved to die. But he thought that Sherlock Holmes was one of the most magnificent and marvelous human beings he knew. The two can coincide. You can be marvelous and you can be damnable. You can be inherently valuable as a being and utterly deserving of destruction at the same time. We have to make that distinction. Otherwise, we don't understand the concept of depravity that Paul is working with here. So analogously to Sherlock Holmes, God respects and admires us as marvelous creations. He made us that way. Why wouldn't he? He admires us in that regard, but he's committed to bringing us to justice and destroying us unless, in his own choice, he chooses to show mercy. But if he were to do what is right, if he were to do what is just with respect to me, he would destroy me, not because I'm worthless, not because I'm scum, but because I'm guilty. So Paul is not here seeking to get us as readers to respond with self-hatred. What he's wanting is to get us to respond with contrition, ultimately accompanied by repentance, that we would change our mind about our attitude toward our Creator. That's what he is ultimately looking for in this gospel that he's going to proclaim. And that contrition and that repentance is not something that comes naturally to us. That's what he's asserting here, is left to nature, we are going to respond with hostility and hatred to God, not repentance and contrition. So I'm making a distinction between the ontological worth of you as a person and the moral worth of you as a person. The ontological worth is the worthiness that is in your being, in your created existence. That's one thing. Moral worth is an entirely different thing. Paul is saying that we have no moral worth, but he's not saying that we have no ontological worth. That's why condemnation is a tragedy. If in the end, at the final judgment, God were just throwing away a bunch of garbage, or God were just, you know, brushing off a bunch of scum off of his creation, there's no tragedy in that. That's where scum belongs. That's where garbage belongs, is to be cast aside and thrown away. The judgment is not going to be throwing away garbage. The judgment is going to be condemning as guilty wonderful, magnificent, tremendous creatures. So we have to work really, really hard to keep that distinction in mind and not translate what Paul is saying about human sin into self-hatred. That's not what he's affirming. And indeed, I would argue that self-hatred is actually one more response of depravity. You are suppressing the truth if you believe the lie about yourself that you're garbage. Because God didn't say that. God has said the opposite of that. So if you choose to believe you're garbage instead, you are rebelling against the God who has spoken the truth to us. And you're suppressing that truth and replacing it with another. How should a believer deal with all those loser pronouncements that echo through our head? I think the crucial thing is to understand where they come from. They didn't come from God and truth. They came from some other depraved human being who was far from being in possession of the truth, making up lies about us for God knows what reasons. From parents constantly criticizing us, a spouse constantly criticizing us, some voice that gets in my head because some other creature, in their evil, in their rebellion, in their damnable behavior, started telling us things about ourselves and intimidating us into believing things that aren't true, and that God himself would, if from heaven, would declare untrue about us. But those voices get very much entrenched in us, and they speak and make their pronouncements very, very loudly. They seem like reality to us. They seem like the truth to us because they speak with such force. That's where we, in our discipleship to Jesus, we have to make a decision. What am I going to listen to? The very remote, faint, distant voice of the truth from God, or the loud, intimidating voice that's right there in my very head? And obedience requires that we listen to the truth from God, however abstract it might seem, however remote it might seem, however lacking in reality it might seem. The truth of the matter is, God's truth just is the truth. And I need to live my life in obedience to the truth that God has revealed, not in obedience to some voice in my head that came from some jerk somewhere in my past and my experience who was lying to me and was doing a number on my head. So we have to resolve to believe what we know to be true, as God taught us the truth, and not believe the loser pronouncements that may continue to echo in my mind. That's the battle of faith. At everywhere you turn, the battle of faith is to believe and act on the truth, and to reject and not act on the lies and myths and deceptions that are all around us and within us. I don't think we have any promise that those loser pronouncements will stop and be silenced. I can't promise that. I don't know anywhere that the Bible promises that. Perhaps they can be softened. I don't even know if we have a promise of that. What I do know is, however much they may plague us for the rest of our lives, it's important to learn not to act on their advice. We need to act on what we know is true, not what those are saying. So the simple fact that we have those voices, that doesn't implicate you, and it doesn't implicate the legitimacy and authenticity of your faith. So don't think that somehow I'm just not believing strongly enough just because I can't rid my experience of those voices. Everyone has them to some degree. Some people have them to a greater degree than others, depending upon their life experience, I think. Our maturity in faith, however, consists in our commitment to ignore what they say, not in the voices themselves ceasing. I don't think we can necessarily promise that. Okay, just briefly. So the synopsis of the argument of part three, and we'll look at it some more in more detail next week. But here's the synopsis of the argument. Due to his innate opposition to God and the moral depravity that flows from that opposition to God, every human being stands without excuse under the judgment and wrath of God. And what is his purpose here? To give a synopsis of that. He wants to establish that it's only by mercy that any human being will ever be able to enter into eternal life. Since every human being stands justly condemned and without excuse under the divine wrath, it follows that unless there is a condition under which God will grant life to someone as an act of mercy, no human being can possibly attain to life. He's going to leave that point in the argument that follows, and that's what I missed for years, is that I thought he was going to go on to continue to establish this point. At the end of part three, he's done making this point. He will allude to it one more time later in the letter, but basically he thinks he's established right up front. Let me assert, none of you are deserving of eternal life. If any of us are going to get it, it's going to be by mercy. The question he's going to take up then is, who is he going to show mercy to? Jews who keep the Mosaic Covenant? Is that who he's going to show mercy to? Or believers in Jesus? And he's going to try to argue that it's believers in Jesus, and whether they are Jews or Gentiles, And no Jew or Gentile really needs to conform to the requirements of the Mosaic Covenant. That's where he's going. But in order to go there, he needs to establish right up front, let's take off the table right away. No one is going to get there because they are owed it. No one is good enough in God's eyes to be rewarded with eternal life because they deserve it. So that's why he's saying what he's saying here, but that'll become clearer as we go on. So, questions, comments?
Jack, I have a question on this, the idea of the objective and subjective wrath of God.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of two parts. The smaller part is just, if it is the subjective wrath of God, it seems like when then it says, is directed from mm-hmm. heaven. Mm-hmm. There is something objective there. It seems like it's not, you know, the 100%, you know, the final day of judgment or something like that. It's, you know, it's like, well, the wrath of God is, you know, 10% of it we're getting now or something like that. You know, this idea of giving people over. So it does seem like there's something objective. God is doing something. I mean, if we think of it as there's what's going on in God's mind, his subjectivity, and then there's what God is doing, being subjective and objective. In some sense, God is doing something.
It's hard. It's really hard to... I go back and forth on whether the giving them over that he's going to talk about, God gave them over to a depraved mind, God gave them over to degrading passions. In my initial studies of Romans, I was making a very tight connection between those two, that the wrath of God, what is the wrath of God? It's his giving them over. There may be some sense in which that's true, but I don't think that's primarily what he has in mind. I've changed my mind about that. That, yes, he is giving them over, and maybe that's a partial reflection of the wrath of God, but primarily what the point that he wants to make is where he gets to in 12, so we stand without excuse. So when that judgment day comes, when the day of wrath and the revelation of the righteous judgment of God comes, how are we going to stand against it? How are we going to defend ourselves? I think that's his focal point in this argument. So I think the wrath that's directed from heaven is the fact that that's his attitude and his disposition toward who you and I are.
So right now we have the... we have enough evidence to tell us what God's attitude is towards our sin, and that there's going to be an actual objective response to that in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. So we know enough to know what that otherwise invisible attitude is. We know what the attitude is, but it's not like we have felt the brunt of that attitude objectifying itself against us. Yeah.
So the second thing that I have is this idea of that thinking in terms of God's emotions, God having, you know, this hatred towards sin and this hatred towards, you know, our where our hearts are, you know, how we are rebellious and how, you know, how we don't take him seriously and how, you know, our attitude towards others. And we can understand that, you know, there's a sense in which God is hateful of those things. I guess what I'd want is a little bit of a unpacking of the idea. On the one hand, we get this subjective idea of God hating sin, but on the other hand, we get this picture of God so loving the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I think of the subjective state of my heart of this hating God. That idea, for a lot of people, they would say, well, I don't hate God, because they don't see this like seething, you know, passionate hatred that we would think of towards God. They just would say, he's not that big of a deal to me, or I don't really think he exists. You know, it's not this deep, profound subjective experience of hatred is just not a big deal. And so, but yet that seems like that's still complete, that would fall totally within your idea of hating God.
Right.
So if it's kind of, there's our subjectivity and God's subjectivity in both of these cases, where a lot of people might say, well, that seems like it's kind of taking the idea of hating God or God hating sin a little bit far if we're trying to really understand it from an emotional perspective.
Yeah, I think the language of emotionality here is not intended to exhaust the concept that he has in mind, as you point out, with our hostility to God. I may not feel hostility to God at all, but in fact, given the concept that Paul wants to get across, not feeling hostility toward God may be the ultimate in hostility toward God, is that I don't even respect him enough to feel hostile toward him, you know? I'm just pretending like he doesn't exist and I'm ignoring him. But what Paul is getting at is a concept that hatred is more or less a kind of metaphor for, I think. It's really the settled state of being of the human heart. And sometimes it erupts into emotions, but it doesn't have to. I mean, if it does or doesn't, it's still the settled state of being of the human heart. And what is that? It's the kind of thing that would erupt in what we call hatred if it were to really manifest itself in a way that is truly reflected by its emotion. So I think thinking of it as more metaphorical language is probably the better way to go. Not that I have any problem, unlike the Greeks who wouldn't let God have emotions, I don't have any problem with having a more biblical notion of God as being a person who has experiences some analog to our emotions. And I say an analog because he's a transcendent being. Of course, he's different than we are. But there may very well be an analog in God's experience to my experience of hatred. But having said that, I think to get the concept that Paul is talking about, it's not really the emotion that's important. It's a deeper orientation of my being that he's really getting at.
Jack, I like your technique, your Socratic arguments when you present things, and it's Jocrates against his opponent, and you carry it out, and it goes into a good explanation, comes out clear in the end. And I would like to paint this scenario where you've been talking to your opponent, and you've convinced him. God's the creator God. He's responsible for the cosmos. As a matter of fact, he's responsible for the ongoing energy. And so your opponent is convinced. But then your opponent says to you, well, gee, God created this cosmos. He created me. He made me this way. Why don't you tell God to get over it, you know, that he's made me in a depraved way? He did it. So I would like you to convince your opponent that, you know what, God had a purpose for creating you this way. How would then you respond to that opponent to bring him to, I think, what you gave an answer already this morning, but could you do it in this way? And the question to the opponent is, you're going to teach him, why did God put us in this depraved state?
Okay. Well, that's a question that I'll be able to address more effectively at other parts of the Book of Romans where where I'm able to lay some groundwork. But with respect to what's going on in this passage, the bottom line is, here's part of human evil. I can easily enough convince you philosophically that God has the right to create people to take into glory and to create people to condemn. Philosophically, that's really not that difficult. What's difficult is to get people to accept that, to bow the knee to that, if you will. And the reason is because in our innate, inherent depravity, we bring God down and we elevate ourselves and we become the ontological peers of God. And in my heart, I go, who does he think he is? Who the hell does he think he is to be condemning me when he made me this way? You know, I mean, just, you know what it feels like. I mean, we all know that argument. We have all felt that argument within our own being. And the miracle is that any of us, that all of us don't stay there. The miracle is that any of us would ever get to the point of saying, you know what? When all is said and done, God is the creator who made every centimeter of reality and every nanosecond of reality, and it wouldn't even exist if he didn't put it there, and I am only a creation. I am only a role player. I am only a character. I am only a part of that reality that he, for his purposes, created the cosmos. And he created his creation of the cosmos was about him, not about me. I mean, that's the other thing that is so endemic to our heart, is we just automatically go to a place of, if there's any truth out there, it's going to be about me. It's the truth about how you ought to treat me and what I ought to get and what my rights are and so on and so forth. It's got to be about me. Well, it's a miracle that any of us ever get to the perspective. I mean, not that we can get there intellectually, that's easy, but that we can get there existentially to the place where we can recognize God really is God and I really am a creator, and the right and appropriate thing for me to do would be go before my creator and say, God, make of my existence what you want it to be. That's a miracle. But it's the miracle that has to happen if we are really going to be the kind of person who's repentant, contrite, and therefore destined for eternal life rather than destruction, is that God's got to perform that miracle in our heart. So I will get to the philosophical arguments eventually as to why that makes the most sense, but the philosophical problem argument is not the issue. That it's not a philosophical obstacle. It's an existential obstacle. It's Kierkegaard's famous leap of faith. Every ditch is infinitely broad to the person who doesn't want to jump. If I don't want to acknowledge God as God, no argument in the world is going to make me do it. There's got to be that softening inside where I finally ultimately decide, you know what, instead of fighting God, doesn't it just make a whole lot more sense to be the creature he made me to be and let him be the creator that he actually is? Maybe I should just bow the knee to the creator and let him make of my life what he wants. But until we do that, we're going to come up with all kinds of objections.
And so your last remark in your Socratic argument to your objector is that God's purpose was to cause us to come into subjection, to recognize our need to be dependent. That's the quality he's attempting to teach us.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, and we'll talk more about this, but when all is said and done, God has created a narrative as a reality with a narrative structure to it that has a strong tragic element to it. There are creatures that he made that are wonderful creatures who rebel against God, and God demonstrates his justice and righteousness and goodness and holiness by, in the end, condemning them. Unless there's a surprise ending where God shows mercy to everybody, and you and I will both be willing to applaud that surprise ending. But that would be a surprise ending, because I don't see the Bible teaching that. It's got this incredible tragic element where wonderful creatures are going to go to their destruction because they thumb their nose at God to the end. That's tragic. But it's... So why did God do that, we can say? We don't ultimately know the answer to that, but I think we have some glimmers of the beginning of some answers to that, in that what is the good part of this story all about? It's about the display of God's profound and deep mercy. God took other creatures in rebellion against God and decided to transform them from the inside and grant mercy to them and give them life that they don't deserve. Well, remember I said, this is not about us, it's about God. The way in which that would be about God is that God is creating a reality that embodies and gives expression to something deep within the actual being of God, this thing that we call mercy. That's part of who God is. A different story would not have embodied and revealed and given expression to that, to the depths of that part of God's being. I think created reality is an act of self-expression on God's part. He's giving expression to who he is. And who is he? He's merciful. And so we begin by creating a race of beings, a set of creatures who deserve destruction. And then we have this unfolding story about how the Creator took these beings who deserve destruction and through a complex narrative brought them to receive of the profound depths of God's mercy instead. Well, it's not about who gets saved, it's about this, the one doing the saving and what a profoundly merciful being he is. So if anything begins to answer, why did he do it this way? That's the why. So that we might know him as he truly is. Another reality would not have expressed that part of who he is. And for whatever reason, his mercy is what he wanted to display in the reality that we're actors in. I've kept you a little over, so I have to let you go. Thank you.